Interesting. Something you said in there reminded me of a recent lecture I heard on the topic of wonder. And this guy gave a basically a lecture where he talks about, you know, Plato's says that philosophy begins in wonder, and that basically, you know, kind of in our somewhat within the scientism of our current age, we often see kind of wonder as this sort of naive imperfection to be overcome. But he was kind of making the case that, you know, if there is some sort of great mystery at the heart of everything, that as you get closer and closer to that mystery, that the wonder might would rather deepen rather than go away. I'm curious because you mentioned this in the book as that we could see science as kind of a vehicle for re-enchanting the world rather as what it has become to many people, kind of a disenchantment, a kind of we know everything, and those that still have that kind of childlike wonder are kind of on the wrong path. Any comment there?
I mean, I think wonder does increase with understanding. So Aristotle's remark is that that knowledge and philosophy begins in wonder and ends in wonder, but it's not the same wonder. It's a much more nuanced, greatly expanded, more granulated, enriched wonder. It's the wonder when you think about music. You can go to a hear a great symphony performed, and it can be wonderful. But when you start to contemplate what it took to say put that performance on, that increases the wonder. When you start to think about the nature of music, how it's not just an acoustic phenomenon on the airwaves, but that somehow conveys this meaning, that increases the wonder. When you know something about the composer and what they were trying to do, where they were coming from, how it fits in with the history of music and so on, music appreciation, that increases the wonder. This is not so surprising when you think about it. And I think science can very much serve that purpose as well. One of the problems that science has got into, I think, often, certainly in the public space anyway, is that it sort of has set itself against older forms of knowledge, and particularly Christianity in the West. And so there is a bit of a tendency to think that science only succeeds when it supplants older forms of knowledge. But really, the minute you start talking to scientists I know anyway, that's not really what they're thinking. They're because they're living human lives at the end of the day. They're still going home and loving their families and going to concerts at the weekends and so on. And even in a writer like Richard Dawkins, who clearly can get on his hobby horse about religion and just hates it, period. When he writes about science and forgets his hatred of religion, it's packed with wonder. That's why he's such a great writer, as well as the sort of bete noire of religion. It's all about to use the Blakean phrase, it's about using fourfold vision, which is sensing and reasoning, but also intuition and feeling, that kind of deep sense of the way things are. It's when all that comes together that life grows.
We have a question in the chat here from Eilif. He says, any thoughts on how this corresponds with the Paradiso by Dante and the concept of understanding the divine essence as the overall purpose to the earthly life in the medieval cosmology?
Yeah, well, I mean, I increasingly feel that Dante is a forerunner of all this, and that particularly in the Paradise, he is showing us a lot of these things already, actually. It's very interesting to me that often when Dante's discussed in the modern world, people kind of get into the Inferno, they get into the Purgatorio, but when it comes to the Paradiso, they sort of pull back and can't make sense of it. But I've been very greatly helped in reading Dante's Divine Comedy, particularly the Paradise, through the Temenos Academy, an organization here in London, and particularly with the guidance of Jeremy Nadler. And it's very clear that what's happening in the Paradise, I think, is that as Dante ascends through the different heavens and then beyond the heavens into the divine Imperium itself, he ascends only because he is increasingly able to perceive that seeing and rising go hand in hand. So Dante's consciousness is evolving all the way through the paradise. You know, so for example, he has to learn to see how the one relates to the many. And the more and more that he can see how the two aspects are in harmony, the higher he can rise. So at first he's quite surprised to see whole souls, say in the heaven of the moon, the first heaven that he enters into. And he asks them lots of questions, but, you know, how come you're here, but you're also with the divine in the highest heaven? You know, what's that about? And how come that you're a person that I knew on earth as well as a person in heaven? You know, how can that come together? And gradually he starts to realize that it's the union of, it's the development of our knowledge, our sight, our desire, our will, all these aspects of ourselves as they develop, they bring us together into the oneness that ultimately joins the divine unity. So reading the Divine Comedy, particularly the Paradise, I think is, I'd go so far as to say maybe it's the sort of the pinnacle of the Christian expression of this mysterious unfolding. You know, many others have got great insights and a genius in their own way at it. I think I'd go so far as to say that, you know, when Jesus in John's Gospel says there are truths which are too hard to bear, but the Spirit will reveal them, that in Dante's Divine Comedy, particularly the Paradise, these things are revealed. And that's why it's a text that imaginatively gives and gives and gives, and you read it again and you just get more out of it every time. It's wonderful. It's a struggle, it's hard, but that's only because it requires your perception to develop in order to see its riches. And, you know, whilst many people that try to engage with the Divine Comedy, you might say in the secular world, struggle with the Paradise, and that I think only says something about the evolution of consciousness today, that we're often in this withdrawn state, which is more the state that's experienced, say, in the Inferno, in hell. You know, in hell, Dante starts to realize that the reason why people stay there is not because they're condemned so much as that they can't experience the present. They're either fixated on the past and what's happened, or they're preoccupied with the future and what's going to happen. And because they can't attend to their present, they can't change, because it's only in the present that things change, that things evolve. And, you know, so that's in a way our conundrum today, I think. You know, we live in a world that that is particularly, I think, fixated on the future. You know, the whole idea of progress, and linear progress in particular. It's the promissory note that science writes, that it's going to understand all things one day. And the great problem with that is that it's very hard to attend to the experiencing that's going on now. But when you can, as it were, withdraw your attention to that moment, then I think things start to open up and you move from the Inferno into the Purgatory, where there's a purification that goes on, enabling you to enter in and rise into the heavens, like in the Paradise. It's amazing. It's a brilliant book.
Interesting. One of the things that made me think about as well is, you know, how do you think these transitions, you know, that we experience, you know, in terms of how you conceptualize them, are they things that that happen to us individually, or is there some role to play for being part of collectives in terms of these transformations of consciousness? You know, is it something we kind of have to go alone on by ourselves, or do you see that there are communal practices or things that are coming back, you know, that maybe from the past that are helping to act as guides into these kind of processes?
I mean, maybe to answer this personally, because people will have different ideas about this because they'll have access to different communities. But I think that the individual work is basic. That, and if you're not doing the work on yourself, and trying to understand your own inner life more, then you know, you always risk spiritual bypassing. going for a peak experience for its own sake, say, rather than really understanding yourself. But I think certainly, you know, I work as a psychotherapist, so I kind of would say this, but I think there's huge benefit to be accompanied on the way with this, because, you know, our capacity for delusion is very great. And also just our capacity to feel stuck and not have the imagination ourselves to find a way out of the things that trap us, and that practices like psychotherapy, psychotherapy that's the depth psychotherapy, I should say. Psychotherapy means different things in different countries, I'm aware. I mean, in the UK, it tends to mean what's called psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is taking inner life very seriously. And that means on the assumption that we don't understand our own inner life very well by ourselves. So that with a psychotherapist, that can unfold more. It's not just sort of behavioral psychotherapy, as psychotherapy can mean, I think, more in the US. So I think psychotherapy, so working with another, can be very valuable. You know, people have spiritual directors. There are other options here as well. Great teachers, that kind of thing. For myself, the collective practice now, it's a bit in the church. You know, I think the Church of England, which is the church that I know, it's not very good actually at personal development, at the evolution of consciousness. It's a very caring institution. It cares a lot about this world in terms of social justice. It still does wander. It still preserves the great buildings of the medieval period and the great music of the medieval period, in particularly in the Gothic architecture. And so is immensely valuable for that reason, because that is an imaginative experience. To enter a great cathedral is an imaginative experience. It is to get some felt sense of the spiritual imagination that produced it. But I don't, myself, it's very rare, I think, to find a church where that's enough on its own. And apart from the personal development, I think also that what certainly the Church of England and Christianity perhaps doesn't do very well is silence. And so I also go along to the Buddhist Society here in London for regular collective silence as well. It's very simple in the sense that it's not full of Buddhist ritual at all, nothing like that. But what is so is that they know how to hold silence. They know how to trust it, how to stay with it. And that is a real art in itself. I think it only comes out of real experience of silence too. And so I find that in at the Buddhist Society. So go along there regularly for that too. So there is a collective practice as well as the personal. Studying, I mean, you know, trying to speak about it, trying to write about it, that too is a practice, as you know, as well. That's a collective enterprise. You know, it's good that you have people who want to listen and offer you feedback. And when you hear yourself speaking, you realize, well, you're not quite getting it right, and so on. So that would be another important practice for me too.
Sherry has a question in the chat. She's curious if you see any connection between Barfield and the writings of George MacDonald, who was famously kind of had a big influence on C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, I just don't really know about that, actually. I just don't know. I think that, I mean, Barfield tended to say that amongst the Inklings, he felt that he was a kind of fount of a lot of their ideas, and that the relationship was that whilst he would provoke thought in them, they would then, particularly Tolkien and Lewis, would use their genius as writers to communicate it in different ways. So I think he did actually feel that in terms of inspiration, it was him offering inspiration that they then ran with, rather than him being particularly influenced by their thought, actually. He did say that was the way it kind of worked.
Quick question. Have you, in terms of the reception of the book so far, have you seen any differences in terms of, I don't know, different strains of Christianity, whether it's, you know, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, or other, is there any nuances in the response that has given you more insight into those different traditions and where they're at right now in the modern landscape?
I don't know actually. I mean, it's a bit too early to say. You know, the book is, I think, if it's going to have an impact, it's going to be through word of mouth, really. So, I mean, I'm doing what I can to give it a good nudge at its launch. It's been out for, well, not even 2 months yet. So I think it is going to be word of mouth, and then maybe something of that will unfold. I mean, the only thing perhaps to say is that the C.S. Lewis community is very well established. Obviously, it's massive, and my sense of that is that there's broadly speaking, you might say, two ways that people read Lewis. And one love the apologist Lewis, which is a more conservative reading of Lewis, and they love Lewis because he fills out what they believe to be the case, and defends it, as it were, against the onslaughts of the modern world. A more conservative readership of Lewis, but there's another readership of Lewis too, which love more the imaginative side of Lewis, that see the note, for example, that Lewis doesn't really quote the Bible ever, and so get a sense that maybe Lewis is in the in as much in the Christian tradition is reaching for a direct experience of the things of which the Christian tradition speaks, and so that direct experience matters to them more. And I think that it's that latter group that are going to be more interested in Barfield, because they'll see how Barfield's experience greatly shaped Lewis's perception. So, for example, Lewis talks a lot about what he calls joy, and joy for him is almost melancholic. It's a kind of a sense of exaltation that was once had and is really desired again now. And I think that that makes sense when you think about Barfield's evolution of consciousness, that I think Lewis realized through Barfield that there had been a time when people experienced this flood and flow of meaning directly, and the great task was how to navigate it. You know, it brings up its own problems when life is flooded with meaning, but that was the task then. And that when Lewis uses the word joy now, he's echoing back, he's remembering that former time and looking forward to a future participation when it's known fully once more, when we've become able to experience, perceive, and navigate it once more. So he fills out a lot of key Lewis terms actually, and I think that I hope that there will be a group of people that will start to feel that Lewis expands more through their reading of Barfield and say their reading of my book.
Yeah, there's a great book. I think it's called Barfield on C.S. Lewis. Have you read that? It's a collection of essays where Barfield kind of reflects on the work of C.S. Lewis, and I found that book kind of helpful in terms of laying out where they kind of where the points of agreement were between them and where kind of Barfield sees things quite a little differently.
It's talks that Barfield gave, isn't it? When after Lewis died, because Lewis died in 1963, and Barfield lives until 1997. And in fact, Barfield, he had a kind of recovery in that period of his life, partly because his own writing returned, but also because he was invited, particularly to the US, to speak about Lewis. Everyone wanted to know about Lewis first, and then they wanted to know about Lewis's oppositional friend, i.e., Barfield himself. And so, yeah, those a lot of those talks have been gathered together in this book, Barfield on C.S. Lewis. It's a good read because partly because they're talks, you know. So their talks are often good introductions.
Sherry has a question here too. She says, does Barfield identify the purpose of the time in between original and final participation?
Yeah. So the purpose, it does have meaning. Our time does have meaning. Because although it's one characterized by a crisis of meaning and alienation, this is the moment where you have to fall in on yourself, but that is the moment where you start to discover yourself too. You know, it's the dying that is the necessary precursor to rising. That is very much the pattern. It's why Barfield's very Christian. He doesn't just see us, as it were, stepping into a kind of universal consciousness. Rising without, first of all, descending. The descending is absolutely the crucial step, because although it's often very, very difficult, you know, really feels disastrous, really does feel like dying and suffering, it's that which is necessary for us to gather our freedom to be able to enter into the rising, and to know ourselves as ourselves in relation to the whole, to the one. You know, so in that sense, it's a very different vision of enlightenment, say, from much older visions of enlightenment, which I think were much more about the dissolution of the self and joining the universal consciousness. You know, this is in sort of pre-Buddhist Indian philosophy, for example. And, you know, it's still in some Buddhist traditions too. It's not nirvana as in snuffing out. You know, when Barthel's quite interesting on this, when he speculates about what might happen to doctrines like reincarnation, which is so big in the East, he doesn't really know himself directly, I don't think, but he does say that he thinks that the goal will not be to not be born, you know, because the point about reincarnation is not to be reborn, to escape the wheel of samsara. He wonders whether there'll be an evolution there too, and that there'll be a kind of combination with the Christian vision that actually it's a new creation, it's a new birth, which will be the goal of things. A kind of a taking up of everything, not a snuffing out of things. So that these are, you know, some of his speculations, but I suspect there's something in it.
Interesting. Yeah, your conversation there about specifically the kind of death and rebirth and where we are now in that process made me think of in the book you made some reference to the original kind of abrupt ending of Mark, where the gospel kind of ends abruptly with the disciples having gotten some good news from an angel, but they're kind of left alone and they don't say anything to anybody because they're afraid. So there's like this, they're kind of left in this kind of internal space of both some sort of hopeful expectation of the future, but also having to deal with kind of the anxiety of where they are right now.
That's my sort of spin on the famously abrupt ending of the Gospel of Mark, which I got also from Blake, because I think when William Blake, his picture of the Marys at the tomb, that too I think is saying the same sort of thing. It's in these strange words which are recorded, like, you know, do not cling to me, and why do you look here? You know, these are very much moments, I think, when we're asked to step up, not just to receive.
Josh has a question here. He says, can you speak on the idea of inversion in understanding and experiencing the world in modern psychotherapy? And then parentheses, he has the ancient man feeling influenced by creation rather than feeling like it comes from within and is projected outwards.
Yeah, I mean, if I've understood correctly, I mean, to make a rather broad brush comment, I think that now when we feel flooded from the outside in is when we kind of have a breakdown. And I think it's because the modern world has forgotten the old practices that enabled our forebears to live in this flood of meaning from the outside in, you know, the way that the whole of life was shaped by myths and symbols and rituals and libations and sacrifices and a sense of the seasons, you know, being alive and the heavens pouring down their rays upon us and so on. You know, in the days of, you know, before the modern period, your whole life was immersed in practices and knowledge, you might say, wisdom that enabled you to navigate this outside in flow of meaning. We've lost that to a large degree anyway. But what we have gained and are gaining, I think, is a new wisdom about inner life through things like psychology, but also through the development of the individual intellect, education more broadly, you might say, which focuses on the individual. Now it's, you know, it's not becoming automatically a kind of spiritual education now at all. That is, as we've been saying, that's the time we're in. But I think that it's the necessary step to a rediscovery of how to navigate and relate to the outside world once more. You know, you get hints and nods of it. Again, I think the ecological crisis, for all the worry there, It's very interesting how it's kind of forcing us to think about the natural world in a different way. So I think there are hints and nods in science too, the kind of crises in science, like say how to understand quantum physics in physics. I don't want to rush particularly to a kind of quantum spirituality. I think that's running far too speedily. But I think it is keeping us in this unknown space of not knowing quite why the science works, even though it's very clear it does work. And that's a very productive space of unknowing to be in.
Well, I guess we've gone on about an hour here. I had one last question from you, for you, if see if anybody else has any other questions before we go. But I'm curious, how has the process of writing this book changed you? I know you probably had some sort of intimation of what you wanted to achieve in writing it, and I'm just curious, any surprises along this journey or anything that's come out of it that's unexpected from what you thought when you first started the journey.
I mean, it was a struggle, and I began to read Barfield for reasons we talked about before, I think, in our previous conversation, because I was trying to understand Plato particularly, actually, and then I realized that maybe he had something to say about Christianity that might be invigorating, and yeah, a whole new perception of Christianity opened up through this sense of Jesus being this pivotal figure in the evolution of Western consciousness. That I had no idea about that before. And then what was really wonderful about writing the book is I felt I needed to write about this in my own way, as much as I can from my own sense of things, not just recapitulating what others have said. And that led me in particularly to look at the Bible as well as ancient Greek philosophy again. And I discovered that particularly in biblical criticism, a lot of the things which are said in that scholarship are quite commensurate with Barfield's sense of things, what happened to the ancient Israelites through the period of the exiles and so on, and what happened in the intertestamental period, in particular. It felt to me like it was bridging worlds between sort of history and spiritual evolution, and that was great. When I started to realize that, trying to write a book is always about trying to write something coherent out of a lot of glimpses and ideas and images and so on. So that in itself is a kind of effort to form a consciousness, a sort of awareness, a perception of things that has some sort of holding together. Again, particularly if you're trying to write it from your own heart, so that you hope in your writing you show, not just tell. But it's also launching me into a new sort of project, really, which I think is going to be Barfieldian in its spirit. It's broadly speaking, what I'm trying to do now is understand how spiritual growth works, and compare that particularly to material growth. And I think, we live in a world which is very, very defined by what it means to grow in material senses, accumulation, sort of physical knowledge. A kind of linear, progressive vision of what it is, but it's clearly inadequate, if not provoking crisis. And what I feel we've lost is what it might be to grow spiritually, which I think has a whole different kind of set of skills and logic, and consciousness to it. A kind of awareness of what life is about. And so I'm just getting into that project now, and I hope that will produce, maybe even a book at some point down the line, because it's something which we need to recover, but in Barfieldian spirit, we need to recover it with where we're at now, from where we're at now. It's not just a regress, it's not just a return, it's not to spiritually bypass, but it is to try and incorporate what can be gained through the alienating experience too, because I think this is key to our freedom. It's always, freedom is the guiding word, I think, for Barfield. He gets that from Steiner. I think it's in the Bible too. My favorite remark of Jesus now, more or less, is my burden is light. My burden is light. It's like a kind of compass that when you feel that expansion, that lightning, that's a sort of suggestion that you're pointed in the right direction. When it and you feel you're getting overloaded, morally demanded upon, all that, you know, that maybe there's periods like that, but ultimately it's not the right direction. So yeah, that's something about what the book's done for me. I had no idea that it would take me in this direction. But it looks like it is.
Very cool. One last question we have here is, what do you think about how virtue can help in the process of one's growth, and what is the relationship it has to joy?
Great question. I think virtue is absolutely key, because what virtue is about, as opposed to morality, is virtue is about who you are as a person. It's about your qualities, your characteristics, and that means it's about how you experience life. I remember having quite a revelation one day when I actually heard a Buddhist teacher say that humility was about putting yourself in the lowest place, because then, like the sea, everything can flow into you. And immediately I thought, this is a participative sense of humility. It's about being able to participate with all that's around you. So virtue, I think, is key. And it's so different from morality, because morality is about do's and don'ts, ultimately. It's about what's right and wrong. And that, it's not bad necessarily, but it's too reduced. It doesn't ask you to expand your perception of things. It just asks you to sort of follow the rules. I think Christianity makes massive mistakes when it presents itself wittingly or unwittingly as a moral system, because it hinders people's growth ultimately. You know, you're not supposed to make mistakes. Whereas in virtue, you always make mistakes, but you make mistakes because you grow. So I think virtue is really key to all this. And one of the things which will, I hope, you know, kind of happen, is that that virtue tradition will start to return as well. It's got rather eclipsed with utilitarianism, particularly in the modern world, but even deontological ethics, as it's called, and the kind of this is what you ought to do, this is what I must do. You know, that's what way too strong in Christianity, in my experience. We need to get much lighter with all that. You know, look to the parables and realize that most of the parables are amoral or immoral. They're trying to show us something completely different. You know, Paul and I talked about this in our last conversation. It's really key, I think, virtue.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Something I hadn't really thought about. I think it seems like with virtue, it's more about kind of, like, as you said, how you're tuned to experience things, the kind of direction you're facing, and that's more important than the kind of facts of the situation and what actually happens. It's more about, like as you said, in some sense, necessarily, if you are growing, you're consistently putting yourself into areas where you will almost necessarily fail, because there's this expansion of your capabilities that, you know, more and more challenging circumstances you're going to fail before you succeed. That's really interesting.
No, I mean, it's part of dying and rising. I think it's also the spiritual meaning, the deeper meaning of remarks like the first will be last and the last will be first and so on. You know, when these remarks are read as dynamic indicators rather than sort of static inversions, you know, that's what you want to look for. You want to follow the energy. Again, this is, you know, back to what we were saying before. When you can see and know these things as about the experience in itself, then you know that you're in the present moment. You're in the moment where things can change. When they're read as rules, as it were, fixing things, that's when nothing actually changes.
Very interesting. Okay, I think this is probably a good place to end. Any last thoughts you have before we head out here?
Well, just to say thank you both to you and to those who've been asking questions and so on, because it does help me as well to sort of to have to think about these things and join a few more dots. You know, I mean, no doubt, like everyone who's listening, I think this really matters as well. So I hope it helps sort of spread the word too.
Agreed. And thank you for joining. And just everybody out there, you can get Mark's book on Amazon. He actually has, there's a Kindle version of it, there's a hard copy version, and there's also an audiobook that's read by him. And I actually have all three because I bought the Kindle when it first came out and then realized I have a hard time reading these days. So I got the audio version so I can listen while I'm doing other things and working out. And you were so kind to send me a physical copy. So, it's a really great book. And I have to recommend that folks check it out because it's, I think, if you kind of go out Barfield alone without a guide, it's, most people that I've talked to have found it a little bit challenging, and I think this does give you, if you have some interest in Barfield, there's certainly this is a kind of a good starting place for starting that journey.
Very much,
But
Mike. I
thanks.
really appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
Yeah, it was. I've really enjoyed the book, and I'm kind of still gnawing at it because there's quite a bit in it, especially in that last chapter, as I mentioned, where it says we need to be mystics. I think primarily because for myself, it's there's some sort of hurdle there in terms of venturing into that mystical world, and I think it perhaps I try to have problems solved before I go into them, and in that mystical space, that's certainly not something that can be done. There's not like a kind of rational, reasonable sort of ladder you can build for yourself to go through it step by step. There's some sort of kind of leap of faith or something of that nature. So, but yeah, I've really found the book very helpful in terms of, I guess, coming to some sort of realization about how important this is, as you just pointed out.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks again so much, and I'm gonna end the recording here.